technology. Hopefully it will load. I've got 20 minutes, okay. And I've got set to this. Is just any key, we'll advance it. And I set it for 3 minutes before it'll start to blink at you, okay?
All right, thank
you. Do you want me to read your title, or?
No, I'll get to this. thank you, Herb, for inviting me here, and congratulations to Phil. I went to ASU in 1993 specifically to work with Phil and to work with a data set called TASS, or from an instrument called TASS, and that instrument was on a spacecraft called Mars Observer. And I now know that Phil will always remember when I came to ASU, because about 3 weeks after I got there, he had probably one of the worst weeks of his entire life. And that was when Mars Observer failed to go into orbit. And in a room full of people huddled around a computer waiting for a blip, when Phil's group was small enough to huddle around a computer, he turned to me and said, "So, are you staying?" And there was no doubt in my mind that I wanted to stay, and I'm tremendously happy that I did. I've learned a lot and had a really great set of experiences. But I think part of the reason that sticks out in my mind is because it was one of Phil's really just classic traits, is that he maintains his sense of humor even in the face of a great deal of adversity. And I think that's something really important to remember all the time. Considering what I went to ASU to do, I think it's particularly fitting that I'm going to talk today about Martian mineralogy and global mapping using the MGS test data set. And this isn't the first time this has been done, and I dare say it won't be the last time it's been done, and I think that in and of itself is also a testament to the data set that Phil has helped collect by developing these instruments. So my goal today is to talk about how we're using improved global mineral maps to perform detailed analyses of the distributions of not just mineral groups, but solid solution phases within those mineral groups on the Martian surface. This has been done already for olivine by Keppen and Hamilton earlier this year. I'm going to talk mostly about pyroxenes today, but this can be done through a whole series of different mineral groups. And the reason this work is important is because it helps us understand better the crustal development of Mars, not just through its igneous evolution, but also through the evolution of whatever chemical and physical processes have acted on it as well. So I'm going to talk about how we got these new maps, what they look like, look in a little more detail at where we're seeing solid solution variations, particularly within the pyroxene series, talk briefly about some very initial results coming out of a collaboration I have going with Deanne Rogers, another student of Phil's, and look at how these results compare to simplified age maps of Mars and what kinds of variations we're seeing chemically as a function of time. So the idea here is that we've used the same methodology as was used by Josh Banfield in 2002 to take a library of mineral spectra and deconvolve the global test data set using that library, using a linear least squares fitting algorithm developed by Mike Ramsey as part of his PhD progress dissertation with Phil. And in our case, what we've done is had a new library that includes spectra of pyroxene and olivine phases that weren't available when Josh did this work back in 2002, as well as a whole host of other phases that are likely to be present on Mars or have been postulated to be present on Mars. And the idea here is that if we are better representing the diversity of mineralogy on Mars in our spectral libraries, there should be an improvement in the quality of the fits that we're getting out of these models, and we should have a better ability to interpret the subtle scale compositional variations as well. So what I'll talk to you about today is our initial verification approach, in which we're using global and regional scale comparisons just to try to get a sense of whether or not what we're seeing looks right. And then as time goes on, we're doing detailed local inspections of the spectral data, because you can run things through a model, but it's really important to get back and look at the actual data. So down the right-hand side are Josh Banfield's maps from 2002. Down the left-hand side are the maps that I'll be talking about from this work. And in the first two sets of maps, the plagioclases at the top and the high-calcium pyroxenes in the middle, even though the abundances represented aren't exactly the same, the basic distributions of these phases are similar. Where we start to see some big differences in our new modeling is in terms of the low calcium pyroxene content, where we're seeing much more than Josh Banfield did originally in his maps. at the top here, we have the olivine distribution. Again, something that Josh's mapping essentially didn't turn up the first time around. We now know that olivine is in fact present, and as I mentioned, this Keppen and Hamilton paper talks about the global distribution of solid solution phases within the olivine series between forsterite and phalite, and there's some really neat story in there. Thank you. But I'm not going to focus on that today. We also see silica phases. Those have been widely debated in terms of what they might mean. It looks like there's some places where these are primary phases, other places where these are secondary phases, and still more places where we're probably not sure yet what it is. And then we have RMS errors. We have nice low errors in the dark regions of Mars, which is exactly what we expect. I should point out, in fact, that Josh's maps don't blot out the areas of high albedo on the surface where those are not mapped here. So to talk a little bit more about pyroxenes, to a mineralogist, pyroxenes are generally first and foremost classified on their structure of whether they're ortho or clinopyroxene. However, in the spectroscopy world, you tend to see discussions of low-calcium versus high-calcium pyroxene. And the reason this is because pigeonite, which is a clinopyroxene, is compositionally similar to the orthopyroxenes, which fall along this join here. Now, Josh used two orthopyroxenes, the two down here. We have added a more iron-rich composition, this one here, that is actually represented by a spectrum of the Allen Hills 84001 meteorite, which is about 98% orthopyroxene. We've also added a single pigeonite here. This is a synthetic pigeonite sample. And then again in the spectroscopy world, high calcium pyroxenes represents things up here in this compositional field, everything but the pigeonite. So now at the top, I've got Josh Banfield's high and low calcium pyroxene maps. These are maps from Omega, published by Bebring et al. Back in 2005, where they show a nice correlation in high calcium clinopyroxene distribution on Mars, but they see quite a bit more low calcium pyroxene in the equatorial regions that wasn't identified in Josh's study. Now, if we go down to our study, we see a very similar high calcium pyroxene distribution as to these other two studies and the other data set from the Visner IR data. But in low calcium pyroxene, we're seeing something very different from both of these. And so this is something that I've been really curious about and trying to dive a little bit further into. This mismatch here really seems restricted to the Syrtis Major shield. Now, if we look in further detail within the low-calcium pyroxene group, look at maps of each of those individual phases that went into the model, we can see that the most magnesium-rich end member, enstatite, is essentially not modeled anywhere on the surface of Mars. Bronzite, which has a little bit more iron in it, pops up here in Syrtis Major and a little bit in the northern lowlands. As you continue to get more iron-rich, you see this composition appearing in equatorial regions, but not in Syrtis Major. And in fact, you can see just a nice little border right here that's very similar to what we see in the Omega data as well. The pigeonite phase, however, seems to be present kind of all over the place. There are some variations, but this is a little bit noisy. So this is something that we're still trying to figure out a bit. If we look at the same kind of information for the high calcium clinopyroxene group, we had four different compositions that were possible there. Diopside, this particular augite, and hedenbergite, an iron-rich end member, essentially not mapped anywhere. Those particular spectra were not used. This spectrum that was used everywhere to create essentially this map is an augite that has slightly elevated levels of titanium. And that, in fact, may indicate that the compositions of these basalts are a little more alkaline than we thought. Now, to move on to another way of looking at these data, looking at maps is one way to get a nice sense of the spatial variation in compositions across the planet, but it's hard to look at more than one or two maps at a time and try to figure out what things are changing and where and what are the different relationships. So with Deanne Rogers, I've been looking at trying to do a statistical analysis of these mineralogies. And the k-means cluster analysis is a nice unsupervised classification that allows us to look at the correlations between all of the minerals all at once. And this is similar to an approach that's been used by Taylor et al. To look at gamma ray spectrometer data. And what you see down here are some preliminary proof of concept results where we tried to break out the derived mineralogies into five different classes. And I wish I'd had time to do this. I apologize, Phil, that I didn't. But I was really tempted to take this diagram and label it highlands and lowlands and spayside and islands and put little scotch bottles off on the sides of this. But what's really kind of key here is that we are, in fact, seeing regional concentrations of these clusters where we have sort of the greens exclusively occurring in the far northern lowlands. We have this yellow cluster occurring in geographically constrained areas. And we have other variations that appear to correlate with geology on the surface. Now, to look at what are these classifications in terms of their mineralogy, I've made this diagram here where the colors on the columns represent the colors here in the figure. And what we see is that these five classes, no single class in and of itself distinguishes all of these classes. But if you start to look at, for instance, okay, well, within plagioclase, you can really kind of tell that green and blue are different. Maybe you can't tell the difference between cyan and red, but green and blue are different in terms of their plagioclase content. Here, olivine is low in the green unit, and you know these, so you can tell it apart from these, and so on. You can kind of bootstrap your way through convincing yourself that these five units actually do exhibit variations in mineralogy. And in fact, when you go in and look at that based on what we expect the trends to be based on what we know from prior studies, we see exactly the trends we expect. This bright green unit up here in the far northern lowlands is extremely poor in olivine, and it's extremely high in silica and plagioclase. This is exactly what we've seen in previous analyses. At the low latitudes, such as this yellow unit, we're seeing low amounts of the silica phases, and we're seeing more high calcium pyroxene, which we saw in the maps as well. So the $64,000 question, or maybe if you're talking to Phil, it might be the $64 question or the $64 million question that day. It varies from day to day. The question then is, what is going on with the high calcium, low calcium pyroxene in Syrtis? You'll notice here that even though Omega data shows Syrtis to be lacking low calcium pyroxene, the maps I showed that it was high there. This class seems to include it with these equatorial materials. So what's happening there? What we did then was take that yellow unit and run the clustering algorithm over it again just to see if there were subdivisions within that unit. And in fact, we did find additional divisions, including one that pulled out this central Syrtis material as being different from the rest of the equatorial and low-latitude regions. So if you again look at the same kind of plot here, you see that there's fairly small differences in composition between all of these different units. And this is actually really exciting to me because we know from prior studies, for instance, Deanne's work from 2007, that in fact Syrtis does have a different composition than these other regions. We've seen in other data sets this difference and other similar differences. And the fact that these are very small absolute differences in composition gives me a lot of confidence that we're actually resolving much finer differences in abundance in minerals on the surface of Mars than this sort of generalized 10 to 15% that we commonly quote. Will Keppen showed that with olivines, you can detect them quite easily down into the 5% level. I think that at global scales, we are actually legitimately detecting differences in composition of that same kind of scale. Now, the other thing here, though, is that if you look at this lumping of low-calcium pyroxene where pigeonite is included with the orthopyroxenes, you'll note that you don't really see a lot of difference, certainly between the green and the cyan units. And so one of the things I went in and then looked at was, what if you break out orthopyroxenes and pigeonites as being distinct from each other? When you do that, you actually see that they are not the same abundances and that between the different units, the relative proportions of those phases actually are changing, which is why you're getting the differences that you see here. So I think the traditional division of high and low calcium pyroxene for spectroscopic results may not actually provide enough granularity for test data. So if we want to compare this to the geologic map, this is a simplified geologic map published by Deanne and Phil in 2007. Now this map is masked to show areas only having albedos less than 0.15, and these two are albedos less than 0.20, so there's a slight difference there, as well as in the latitudes where this goes to plus and minus 90 and these are plus and minus 60. But what I've done here is kind of called out a couple key spots. Acidalia and Chrissy here with Hesperian materials farther north and Amazonian materials on the south. You look at the classification map. This is the first classification map, and you actually see correspondence between the classes here and those age units. If you look here out kind of by Solis, you see another Hesperian unit, and when we looked in this subdivisions of the yellow unit, we see that, again, this is a different unit than the adjacent materials, which corresponds loosely to this surface age variation. And again, Syrtis, clearly a Hesperian unit based on its visible geologic properties, again, turns out to be compositionally distinct. It, however, is also distinct from the other Hesperian units. So there's a lot of complexity going on here, but there's a lot of really nice correlation with what we see in terms of the geologic mapping of surface age. We can also do this comparison by going back to the mineral maps for a minute and see that, again, if we look out at the surface age in the northern lowlands, we see that the one of the orthopyroxene phases, the bronzite, has a few little detections up here in the northern lowlands corresponding to this Hesperian terrain, also in Syrtis. When you flip to the next most iron-rich orthopyroxene, this is the Alan Hills spectrum, you see that abundance sticks mostly to the Noachian terrains. And you see this boundary here between the Hesperian and the Noachian. In terms of olivines tend to be mostly focused in the Noachian regions. And then the high calcium pyroxene is present in both the Hesperian and the Noachian. So not all phases show distinct time trends, but some of them do. And for instance, this trend here from iron-rich orthopyroxene in the Noachian to more magnesian orthopyroxene in the Hesperian may be telling us something about the igneous evolution of the sources of those materials. So to summarize, we do have these new test mineral maps, and those maps, along with some classification techniques, I think are revealing distributions of compositions that we hadn't seen before. And they're providing us better insight into the interrelationships between these changes in mineralogy from place to place. In particular, Syrtis Major is particularly notable in being different from almost everywhere else. And that difference is not just related to mineral group abundances, pyroxene versus plagioclase, but also the solid solution compositions, which pyroxene. The titanium augite that we're seeing may indicate that Martian basalts are closer to the boundary between alkaline and subalkaline than we had thought previously. This has been proposed, or McSween et al. Have looked at alkaline rocks in Gusev Crater and identified that kind of chemical trend. So it's not necessarily unrealistic that we should have a broader suite of more alkaline rocks on the planet. As I was just describing, olivine tends to correspond to Noachian terrains. The silica phases seem to be greatest in the Hesperian. We have these more iron-rich orthopyroxenes in the Noachian transitioning to magnesium-rich orthopyroxene in the Hesperian. Again, these are all compositional distributions that seem to correspond with particular periods in Martian history, and that suggests that the processes have evolved, tapped different or changing sources, in addition to any chemical weathering or mechanical fractionation that's going on. So we're continuing to look at these data in more detail. This is, again, I would give the caveat that these are global scale correlations. Trying to pick out things at the 5% level in small locations is going to be challenging, but that's the next step to this and to try to push down those detection limits even further. Thank you.
Thank you, Vicki. We have time for questions and comments.
Pat? Vicki, you're explaining all of these variations in terms of different kinds of igneous rocks. Do you think it's possible?
I didn't mean to imply that all of the variation was igneous or primary, mostly restricted to the pyroxenes and the olivine compositions changing or moving through time. The high abundances of the silica in the north clearly, I think, have, you know, been proposed to be an alteration product. That's entirely possible. These correlations may help discern if those kinds of processes were occurring at a certain period in time. But I certainly don't think that these results are telling us anything about primary versus secondary. That's kind of do you leave that, you know, how do I want to say this? Well, I think the trick, well, what do you, let me ask you what you mean.
Well, there's evidence that olivine gets selectively dissolved in acidic weathering environments. So you've got a big variation in olivine abundances. I wonder if some of that could be weathering rather than primary igneous.
It could be, but I'm not entirely sure how you pick out where it's gone because it's weathered versus where it's gone because it was never there to begin with. But I think in terms of igneous evolution, saying that you've got more iron-rich pyroxene in one location and more magnesium-rich pyroxene in another, you know, that's the potential igneous trend, not the presence or absence.
Time for one more.
It depends on the location, but I mean they're not. Unfortunately, there's more things that go into RMS error than just one or two new phases, and so Josh's library was simpler in a lot of ways. Ours is a little more complicated. In a few locations, the RMS errors are higher. But there's sort of, you know, higher doesn't necessarily mean worse. There's sort of a, you know, an envelope of things that are all acceptable fits. I'm not sure if that's answering your question or not.